развитии ШОС. Впервые за время существования организации запускается процедура приема новых членов Индии и Пакистана.
President Putin's this statement at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit last week says everything. He talks about start of the official process of India and Pakistan's admission to the organization. If everything goes as planned, these two countries will be full member of the bloc by 2016. Listening to the speech, the Indian Prime Minister Modi also has Pakistani counterpart Nawaz Sharif was jubilant. Here's what Sharif has said in the summit.
We are about to witness a turning point in the history of Shanghai Cooperation Organization as it initiates the process of inclusion of new member states, including India and Pakistan, into its ambit. I am confident that SCO's expansion would prove a watershed in the changing geopolitical landscape of the Eurasian Belt.
If that dream comes true, the bloc will consist of countries which are home to almost half of the entire global population. India, China, Pakistan, Russia are the biggest countries, so among the members there are countries in Central Asia with least populations. So the question is where the expansion of Shanghai Cooperation Organization puts these small countries in the organization. What they stand to gain or lose from this move, how this affair will change the entire direction of the organization, and what will it mean to Central Asia? Hello, welcome to the Majlis. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the show and director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. To discuss these questions, we have a distinguished panel of experts. Joshua Kusira, Eurasia Net journalist, is joining us from Russia, who was present in the summit. Dr. Alexander Kuli, prominent Central Asia watcher, author of the Base Politics, and obviously newly appointed director of the Harriman Institute at the Columbia University, is joining us from Washington, D.C. today. Dr. Kuli, welcome and congratulations.
Thanks very much. It's good to be with you.
Here in the studio, as always, Bruce Panier, editor of the RFERL Central Asia blog, Kishlak Awazi, is here. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's begin with the hard question. Where the proposed admission of the Pakistan and India to Shanghai Cooperation Organization puts tiny Central Asian countries, what they stand to gain or lose from this expansion? Dr. Kuli, I read the Newsweek story and predictions you made there, so let's begin with you.
Yeah, well, I think what they stand to gain is a perception that the organization has become more important, that it's expanded its membership into these new important emerging countries. Obviously, you know, this line about the SCO membership being half of the world's population is one that's going to be trotted out. So it certainly enhances the prestige of the club. I'm not sure what it does materially, either in terms of the prospects for improving certain issues that have been on standby for a while, for example, a regional development bank or a financing vehicle. And I also think it's going to add to some of the efficiency problems of the organizations. In other words, when it was five members, and then obviously you had to China, or rather went from Shanghai 5 to the SCO, the Central Asian members had a great say in it. They were real players. They used it as a form to balance interests between China and Russia. Now with the addition of India and Pakistan, I think, you know, there's a fear amongst the Central Asian countries that maybe some of their voice and some of their decision-making will also be lost. So I think it's a balance. You gain a little more prestige, in some cases a lot more prestige, on certain issues through these members. But in terms of actual coherence and voice in the organization, there's a concern that might be eroded.
Josh, are there fear among Central Asians? You've been just in some of those countries in your last trip.
Well, I think that, I agree with what Alex said, that there's a fear that they will lose a voice. You know, with India and Pakistan now, there's four huge countries, nuclear powers, and four, you know, relatively poor and small and not powerful Central Asian countries. So I think that there's, you know, legitimate concern that they would be outweighed in SCO decision making. But I mean, I think that the big thing that the SCO has to figure out now is what it actually does, and only then will we be able to really determine what the impact of this accession is going to be. You know, the development bank that was supposed to be big sort of news out of the summit, it doesn't seem to have materialized. I don't know where the status of that is now. It's sort of de-emphasizing its place as a security sort of guarantor, a collective security bloc. And so, you know, I think it's still an organization in search of its mission. And until it figures that out, we don't really know what the effect is going to be of adding India and Pakistan.
Bruce, we have been seeing at least some level of concerns being already expressed by some of the Central Asian leaders out there. We have been talking in the example of Islam Karimov. What kind of reaction do you expect or you have already seen in the region into these new potential members to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Well, as you mentioned, Uzbek President Karimov, when he arrived, singled out Putin immediately and said, we need to talk about what this change means and what it, you know, how it has to, what kind of effect it's going to have on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And even when the meeting was over, he still seemed to be unclear as to how this is going to change it. But it was pretty clear from his comments that he was not particularly happy that this was going on at this time. So there certainly are a lot of questions about what role, you know, how great a role Pakistan and India are going to have in this. You know, we've made the point that the Central Asian countries just went from being equals, more or less, at least formally on paper, you know, and they'll probably still remain that on paper, but they've really been pushed to the back by this. You know, the total population of all four of the Central Asian countries that are in the CSO, or SCO, excuse me, are is half of Russia, and that's the next smallest country in terms of population. So, you know, they're going to have to expect that their concerns, while they're going to be listened to, might not necessarily be addressed when this goes on. You know, now Nazarbayev is more diplomatic, and Atambayev is certainly a little quieter, and so is Rahman. But they certainly must feel the same kind of concerns that with these two countries that just entered, you know, in Italy, India in particular, which is huge, that they're going to get really pushed back to the, you know, to the back of the class, so to speak, and that a lot of the things that they think are important might not be considered as important by the other ones. I would add at this point, though, that one of the biggest concerns for the Central Asians and certainly for President Karimov has always been security. And with China and Russia still in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, security in Central Asia will remain one of the foremost issues for the group. How Pakistan and India will influence how they operate is still an open question, but they certainly don't have anything to worry that their security concerns will be forgotten. That won't happen.
There is also economic and social dynamics there. Dr. Kuli, I think the question on who plays what role, it must already be part of the charter. How does that kind of decision takes place in the Shanghai Cooperation Organizations?
Well,
and I'm just asking in terms of the issue of equality here.
Right. So legally, this is the SCO's public face, the idea that this is a new type of international organization among sovereign eagles. There's no hegemony. There's no internal interference in domestic politics. And there's this Shanghai spirit, this spirit of community and friendship and intercivilizational dialogue. Informally, it's really perceived as China's organization. China calls the shots. And the problem for the SCO is that China and Russia, its previous two big members, have been at odds as to what that elusive SCO agenda that Josh rightly points out is. For Russia, this has been a vehicle to try and push back against Western influence, right? And this is why you see a lot of these declarative statements about Syria, about missile defense, about U.S. hegemony, the military bases declaration in 2005. China instead wants to see the organization actually do things in the region, provide public goods, be an economic vehicle. Initially, they had hopes that it could be a free trade bloc. That was not agreed to by Russia and the other members. Then it wanted to have this development bank, an anti-crisis fund. And at every point of the way, Russia has blocked the economic agenda that China would like to see it. So the problem is that there's a lot of talk about its importance, but there's no agreement as to what that agenda really should be. Now, one of the big reasons India and Pakistan are getting in now, I believe, is that the Chinese have recognized that the SCO is not going to be a coherent economic organization. I think they've given up in some ways clashing heads. And I think most importantly, it's no longer at the forefront of their regional economic efforts. Instead, you've seen the unveiling of the new development bank in the BRICS, the new Silk Route Fund, which is under the People's Bank auspices in Beijing, and of course, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. So China now has several other funding vehicles to pursue its economic agenda. And my perception of this is that the Chinese have just said, you know what? India gets in and Pakistan get in as a joint package. We'll increase the prestige of the organization, but we have these other kinds of tools for our economic agenda now.
I'm also sure that China knows where it is getting to by helping Indian admission to the bloc. I mean, India's population is almost following the Chinese one. If that organization allows the free traffic of labor activity from one country to the other country, if the India will have its own share in Central Asia, I believe, if that is the case. And also in terms of economic expansion, India is not doing less than what the China is doing at suddenly, it got a kind of a new competitor in a block that it has created. I think China should be aware of that. I'm just trying to, you know, put some counter argument to what you have said, Dr. Cooley.
I think if you look at the actual data of trade flows between the region and India and China in the region, you'll see that they're not competitors in any meaningful sense. Indian economic activity is still an absolute fraction of what Chinese economic activity is. Three, 4 years ago, it was actually 2% of what Chinese activity was. And, you know, it's risen now a little bit. But these in no way are equal economic powers in the region. In terms of, you make a very interesting point regarding sort of, you know, the open movement of labor, possibly migration and so forth. There's a lot of hurdles to getting there, presumably, because then if you were to open this up as a space, Russia would have to be on board. And, you know, Russian migration policy is something that they take very seriously. I don't see that on the agenda. I see this more as a kind of a concession to Russia and India. But at the same time, a kind of a refocusing of the organization's mission, that it is going to be a kind of a pan-Asian mission with lots of prestige. It's going to be involved in lots of different things. China, I think, will keep operating in regional fora in which it calls the shots.
That different thing also includes, Dr. Cooley, military security?
So security, yes. Josh can comment on some of the security issues in a more informed way. But I think that it's been really the Chinese security agenda that's been taken by the SCO. If you look at the SCO's actual security agenda, it's to combat extremism, terrorism, and separatism. Yeah. This is also the Chinese security agenda. In terms of regional security, defense, peacekeeping, you know, these times of more, you know, integrated air defense systems, these kinds of issues, this is really the CSTO's bailiwick, right? And Russia insists that partnership and regional cooperation takes place through that vehicle. So instead, what you have, this agreement on security as a kind of internal security agenda, with the exception of these periodic, you know, Shanghai Cooperation Peace Mission exercises that they do under SCO auspices. So even on the security agenda, there's a Russian-Chinese division of labor there and a split. I actually think, you know, the Indians might see the SEO also as a potential entryway into getting this long coveted base that they wanted to in Tajikistan. But again, I think Russia, SEO or not, is still going to have reservations about permitting another external power to base in Tajikistan.
Josh, we have been trying to understand the recent expansion of the organization from the Central Asian points of view. And if you look at what Chinese or Russian intention behind this expansion, how you read that, and again, we were talking about various economic issues and also military aspects we touched with Dr. Cooley here. So is there any military intention behind this expansion here in this in recent summit that we have witnessed?
I don't think that there's any, I think that the direction of the military cooperation is going down. I think that, as Alex said, I mean, I think there's been a sort of tacit agreement between China and Russia, and maybe behind closed doors, it was an explicit agreement that, you know, that Russia would kind of tolerate China's economic expansion in Central Asia as long as they didn't try to displace Russia's role as the main security actor in the region. And I don't see so far any evidence that's changing. And then so as a result, the CSTO, which doesn't include China, which is dominated by Russia, that has taken the lead in Central Asian security, while the SCO, dominated by China, has been much more active economically. And I don't think that any of that is going to change. Nothing that was said at the summit. I mean, they talked generally about fighting terrorism and so on. But, you know, the main security activities that they've been undertaking are sort of kind of legal ones about extraditing, you know, quote-unquote terrorists from one country to another, which I think in practice mainly means, you know, Uyghur activists who
at least from Chinese perspective,
refuge in Central Asia, right? And so in terms of the military, you know, it was interesting that the last peace mission exercise, you know, Russia has been really talking up the SCO a lot since the sort of crisis with Ukraine and the fallout with the West. And it was interesting that in the last peace mission exercises last year, the Russian contingent was much larger than it had been. I'm forgetting the numbers now, but they did seem to put a lot more effort into, you know, into those last exercises. I don't know what that means, but I think in general we can expect that still there will be not a lot of military aspect of the organization. And I think adding India and Pakistan makes that even less likely. I mean, you know, makes a military component to the organization even less likely because of the sort of decision-making issues that we've discussed before.
Bruce, what's your take? I mean, what is the Chinese-Russian intention behind this expansion?
You know, the thing about Russia and China are, I think that they're, although they're cooperating within this organization, I think that their behind-the-scenes goals are often different as what they can get out of this. And I'll use the example of China economically, for instance. When the Shanghai Five were cooperated, it was supposed to be a confidence-building organization. They were going to withdraw their militaries a certain distance from the common border that they had. China then proceeded to use the SCO as a vehicle to project its economic influence into Central Asia, you know, which absolutely has come at the Russian expense in the last 15 years. There's no doubt about it. So my question was, by letting India and Pakistan in, what is the purpose between letting them in exactly?
Yeah.
And the thought occurs to me, and I wonder if Russia isn't trying to help balance out the bigger powers at the top to fend off a Chinese foray into the area and some other aspect of, you know, obviously they've overtaken them in economy, but just to have someone like India and Pakistan head off China if it comes to it and say, look, you can only go so far on this. You know, whatever it is, if it's security issues or something like that, so that it's not just Russia and against China, it's Russia plus with Indian support telling China there's a line here that you shouldn't cross in Central Asia. It's not in the common interests of the whole group. Because yeah. I really do think that Russia was surprised by how China very effectively used the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to just overwhelm Central Asia with its economic influence and to supplant Russia hugely in the region. So that's why I'm saying I think, although they cooperate within the organization, I think what Russia wants out of the organization and wants it to do and what China wants out of the organization and wants it to do are two different things. Now you've added two new actors, very big actors, too, in the region. And to some extent, I would imagine China and Russia will be playing on both these new members to come to their side and get what they want out of Central Asia.
Alex, please jump in. And I just wanted to add
here. I just want to jump in there on Bruce's analysis, because I think this whole episode instructively reflects on where we are in the Russian-Chinese relationship. Like Bruce, I think, says, the Russians have wanted India in for a while now as a kind of internal balancer to China to sort of try and dilute Chinese influence. So they get that. Of course, they come in with Pakistan. That's a, package deal. And Pakistan is more and more an economic client of China's, as well as a security partner. But it also tells us a lot about China's confidence, right? The fact that, they no longer see this as, that much of a geopolitical cost to pay. They have such a confidence at the moment regionally about where they are and all the various networks, institutions, organizations that they are currently spearheading, that they're fine with this. So I think, even though it's meant to be this balancing move, I think sort of the Chinese are also going to use this for their own purposes. And they also have a lot of economic interest in terms of One Belt, One Route, wanting to enhance, economic cooperation, certainly with India and Pakistan.
Right. There are two points I want to make here. One is, and now we are talking about the so big issues of those huge countries in their interests. And then suddenly you have in the group some of the tiny, tiny, small Central Asian countries and their minor little interests. So they are going to be kind of irrelevant in this big discussion, it seems to be, going forward. And the second thing is, with the Pakistan and India joining the group, it also means that 4 out of 7 officially declared nuclear powers coming together in the same group. How will this affect into the future, into the direction of the organization going forward? Who wants to take this question?
I think that the nuclear issue is not, a sort of direct importance. I mean, Karimov, in his statement, which Bruce rightfully pointed out, I think was kind of the most interesting thing to come out of the summit, when Karimov kind of objected to India and Pakistan joining, it was on the grounds that they were nuclear powers and that, adding these nuclear powers would, I don't remember his phrase, change the balance of forces in the region or something like that. I don't think that the actual fact that they're nuclear powers is important, but I think that the fact that that is a sort of evidence that they're so much stronger. So I don't really know that there's that much, in spite of what Karimov said, I don't think the nuclear is all that important. It's just a proxy for them being so much stronger than the Central Asian states.
Yeah, and we've got to be careful in this sort of reading out capabilities or having something that somehow this is going to translate into a cooperative agenda. I remember back in 2007 when there was a lot of talk that, the SEO could become a natural gas cartel, right? Especially if it admitted Iran and so forth, or could become an energy club because of all the vast resources there. And clearly these countries are using these assets and, they have, their own individual energy policies. And so, I think it's the same thing on the nuclear issue. There would have to be an awful lot of organizational and regional legwork to somehow have some sort of platform here for some sort of cooperative agenda. But again, it gets back to this idea of prestige, that now you have two new nuclear powers enhancing the prestige and the importance and the status of the organization. But that's different than any actual kind of regional integration agenda.
to follow on the discussion of what, you know, Russia's versus China's interest in this is, I mean, I think the show aspect that Alex just was talking about is very much Russia's agenda here. They want to show that, you know, they're very concerned about the you know, fallout with the West, and they want to show that they're not isolated, and that was the big sort of mission of the summits that they just had in Ufa, to show that we have a lot of allies, and then adding Pakistan and India is you know, a fantastic vehicle to that. I think China is much less interested in these kind of showy gestures, and is in fact, you know, actually trying to accomplish things economically in Central Asia, and having determined that the SCO, due to Russia's previous obstructions, was kind of a useless organization for that, they've given up on the SCO. And, you know, one analysis, I think this was Alexander Gabuet from Carnegie, actually suggested that the, you know, China's motivation for finally allowing India and Pakistan in was a sort of deliberate sabotage of the organization, that, you know, it would make it even more unworkable than it already was, because they have, as Alex enumerated before, you know, their new sort of, you know, one Belt, One Road, and the bank, and so on, gone ahead with their practical agenda. And if they're, I think they're maybe, you know, paraphrasing here, obviously, they're saying, you know, if Russia, you want to use this as a platform to kind of show that you have friends, you know, go ahead. We're going to do our own thing.
Right, right. Colleagues, we will take a short break here. We've been talking about interests of various parties and expansion of Shanghai Cooperation Organization. After the break, we will get into the second leg of our discussion. Welcome back to the second part of the Majlis. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Director of Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Joining me from Washington, D.C., Dr. Alex Coley from Russia, journalist Joshua Kosira, and from Prague here in the studio, Bruce Panier. So truly a global summit is taking place here in the studio. Welcome back, gentlemen. During the OFA summit of Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, Russian President Vladimir Putin has also said something indicating that the expansion of the organizations will continue in the future. Some of the new members might include some nations in Caucasus, and also Cambodia in Nepal. So it brings me to another subject, which is Afghanistan. As you know, President Ghani of Afghanistan was also present in the meeting, and looking into the eyes of Shanghai Cooperation Organization members, he made some bold statements. First, take a listen what Mr. Ghani had to say in the summit.
Terror and narcotics. Where do the terrorists come from? A significant number of them come from your countries and use our territory to destabilize your countries or other countries of the region. We need to recognize the problem and acknowledge it, that these are people who do not have a political problem with us, the government of Afghanistan. They have a design to destabilize our region.
Josh, ahead of this summit, we heard that Afghanistan is going to be one of the agenda of the summit at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's meeting. Was Afghanistan on the agenda? What was discussed about that country?
Well, I don't know that there was very much specifically, at least that was released publicly discussed. I mean, I would say that statement by President Ghani is pretty self-serving and disingenuous, and sort of fits with all of the regional actors, and including Afghanistan, in terms of using the idea of a foreign threat in Afghanistan for their own purposes. And from the Afghan government's perspective, I mean, playing up the international angle of the insurgency against the government, you know, is a great way for them to get help from, you know, the West, from the United States and so on, but also, and NATO, but also now from possibly Russia and China and the other SCO countries. So, I mean, it's very much in his interest to play up the foreign angle of the insurgency there, but I don't think that that's, you know, a very significant part of it. But I do think that what the SCO does in Afghanistan, if they're able to actually do anything in Afghanistan, that would go a long way to proving that they're a useful organization, because now, I mean, they're almost entirely encircling Afghanistan, especially if they add Iran like they're expected to. And Afghanistan is obviously the big problem in the region, the center now of the Afghanistan region. So it will become a big issue, especially if and when the U.S. and NATO eventually pull out.
Right. Yeah, of course, Josh's point was something that was also considered by the Obama administration when they first came to power. The idea that somehow the SCO could be a useful partner in regionalizing Afghanistan, you know, and part of sort of, you know, the AFPAC strategy and so forth. You know, I think the problem, as it's shown in terms of its competence, is that its members are actually deeply divided in terms of a strategic outlook on Afghanistan. Even, you know, this one issue that you hear over and over again, you know, agree on the counter-narcotics issue and so forth. And of course, it's a huge human security issue for Russia, but so many of the security services and border guards of the Central Asian states are themselves implicated in the narcotics trade. So, you know, it's a real problem in terms of you know, how are you going to create a common organizational agenda when its individual members, you know, themselves have such differences over how to prioritize Afghanistan and what tools they should use. Also, I wouldn't expect anything dramatic on the Chinese end. China has maintained consistently that they can do economic help, they can do technical assistance, they can do some training on the police and security front. Now they want to do a little bit more in terms of acting as possible mediators and go-betweens. But China also relies on Pakistan as an interlocutor. So China is certainly concerned about Afghanistan. I think the concerns increased. Whereas for Russia, the sort of Afghanistan spillover threat is something that justifies and gives it reason to be engaged in military terms with Central Asian states. So these bases that exist, places like Kant and in Dushanbe, that used to be these kinds of prestige assets, now all of a sudden have this purpose, right? We're there, common CSTO, Russian Central Asian Security Cooperation to guard against spillover. And plus some, you know, pointing to a little bit of instability on the Afghan Central Asian border also allows the Russians to say, look, you know, the West is picking up and leaving a mess once again, and this is why we have to sort of fill in the void. So again, on the Afghanistan issue, different agendas, different instruments by the member countries, and I'm not sure that adding India and Pakistan to the equation is going to give it any more coherence.
Right. Here I want to make some point. I mean, whenever we speak to experts outside of Afghanistan, people put a counter argument against some of the Afghan officials say about the size and concerns that they have about the security or deteriorating security situation in parts of Afghanistan. I believe that there are some level of exaggeration on that. That could be because they want to attract more support and help. Josh, actually, I'm just putting a counter argument to what you have said. We also see in recent months, weeks, the security concerns, not only in the south of Afghanistan, but also in northern Afghanistan, has dramatically deteriorated. I mean, it started from the Badakhshan, for example. There was a huge attack on the military posts, and then militants were able to hold off one entire district for so many days. And following that tragedy, several police officers were killed, and Afghan officials also said that there were some Central Asian militants were playing a big role in that. And then you have seen a situation in Kunduz province, for example. Both of these provinces borders with Central Asia. And as we speak today, Faryab, another province which has a border with Turkmenistan, is in serious trouble. I mean, there is a reason to be concerned. I'm not talking about whether there will be a case of spillover from Afghanistan to Central Asia, but we certainly see that the security situation is deteriorating, and there are sizable Central Asian militants taking part in those militants' activity there. Now, the question is, now, recently, the Afghan authorities, again, President Ghani has echoed this in his statement in the summit. Afghan authorities are calling to Central Asian governments to share burden of protecting the security. Now, in the last discussion we have had here, we almost got into an agreement with the panelists that, you know, this message is not going to be responded by Central Asian countries positively. So now, Shanghai Cooperation Organizations, being an umbrella organization of all of those Central Asian countries, is there a role that this organization can step in and play in Afghanistan in the face of that deteriorating security situation? Bruce, you might wish to jump in this case.
Well, of course, I was one of the ones that said that the Central Asians wouldn't help out Afghanistan at the last panel discussion. And I really don't see past, you know, very little material aid, certainly nothing to do with weapons. You know, it's in all their interest that this problem is contained within Afghanistan, and they will probably work as much as they can to keep that part of the agenda, to try to contain it within Afghanistan. What they would do to actually prop up the Afghan government, I think they would come at it from the other end, to tell you the truth. I think they would prop up the country surrounding Afghanistan, to, as I said, to try to contain the threat first before they would actually move to help the Afghan government neutralize the threat within the country.
Right. Anyone who wants to add into in this aspect?
Yeah, I would add. I mean, yes, I agree with you that absolutely the security situation in northern Afghanistan has significantly deteriorated, and you guys have done the great reporting on especially the Turkmen angle of that. And I would add that now, you know, the Turkmenistan is not a member of the SCO, and that seems to be, if there is any kind of real threat of spillover, it does seem to be in the direction of Turkmenistan, and yet Turkmenistan is not in the in this SCO. I don't know, you know, you could speak to this better than any of us, Mohammed, probably. You know, I'd be curious to know, you know, whether it does seem like Turkmenistan is taking tiny baby steps away from this notion of neutrality, whether they would ever consider, I don't know, cooperating with the SCO. I don't know that. But I would, to follow up on the question of spillover, though, I would say that it's a very big difference to have, you know, instability in the northern regions of Afghanistan and then and spillover. I think that the connections between northern Afghanistan and Central Asia are not very strong, and I think that even if they are ethnic Turks and ethnic Tajiks and so on in the insurgency, the number of actual people from Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan are relatively small. And you see, if there are people who, you know, from those regions who want to go to fight in some sort of, you know, Islamist struggle, they go to Syria. They don't really go to Afghanistan. And if you look at, you know, for example, and I also think that the, well, we don't get too much into the spillover question, but I do think that the SCO hasn't really shown any kind of capability of taking care of Afghanistan problems because of what Alex said, the you know, widely varying goals that each of the member states have.
Well, and let me just add too that they haven't. In Central Asia, there's been several security problems since the SCO was formed, and they haven't intervened in those either. Kyrgyzstan, two revolutions, ethnic violence in Andijan, and besides being like a kind of a support group for the governments in Central Asia when they needed it against in the face of international criticism, they've never acted. And I can't see why they would go beyond the borders of their member states and actually take a hand in hostilities in an outside country.
There you go. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on the subject. We have to leave it here. Many thanks for all of you taking part in the program. From the United States, Dr. Alexander Coley, director of Harriman Institute at University of Columbia, Joshua Kosira, journalist who was covering SCO Summit in Ufa, Russia, Bruce Pioneer, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. And listeners, thank you very much for the listening to the podcast. Let me remind you, we always welcome your thoughts on the subject. You can get in touch with us via rferl.org, or you can post your comments on Facebook/rferl, or you can follow us on Twitter at rferl. From me, Mohammed Tahir, and all of the team in Prague, thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.